The Chinese ink I used as a dye had worn away before I reached Lhasa, and in my present dwelling, with the cracks in its doors and walls, through which my neighbors could peep at any time, I had not dared to darken it afresh. It no longer matched the braids of jet-black yak hair that I wore, and the latter had gradually lost a large part of their substance, until they had become as thin as rats' tails. They were all right, however, with the bonnet on. They shadowed my forehead enough to reproduce vaguely the hairdress of some Dokpa tribes. But now that I had to obey that horrid little toad and take my bonnet off, I knew that I should look funnier than any clown in any circus in the world. However, escape was impossible. I had my bonnet under my dress, as I was ordered to DP, and rejoined my companions. Yongden had lingered a little, waiting for me. At the first glance, stricken with terror, he opened his mouth wide and hardly suppressed an exclamation. "What have you done?" he said, in dismay. "Who took your bonnet away?" "I am not allowed to precede WTH it on," I answered hurriedly. "You look like a demon," he continued, trembling. "I never saw such a face in my life. Everybody will stare at you. A little more, and I should have cried." However, I derived some comfort from the complete indifference of the two villagers, who did not appear to notice anything wrong or peculiar in my appearance and listened eagerly to their guide, as he related stories about gods, holy men and Dalai Lamas of yore. Others joined them, commenting on the profound learning of the kind Lama. I followed with the crowd, jostling along the corridors, in the steep staircases and narrow shrine doors, and none of them looked at my extraordinary head. I was the only one to feel it, and I began to enjoy the fun myself. As for Yongden, a little reassured now, he did not dare to look at me too often, lest he should laugh aloud. At last I reached the upper terrace, which is occupied by the Chinese pavilions, whose elegant and glittering roofs had appeared to me the day I arrived from China, announcing that the goal was near. After a few hours I went down, and only then a pilgrim seemed to realize that there was something unusual in my appearance. I heard him saying to his friends, "Where do you think she came from?" But he at once found the answer himself. "She must be a Latke," he concluded. So we went on, having reached the top of the dominating Potala, and enjoyed the beautiful sight of Lhasa, its temples and monasteries, lying at our feet like a white, red, and gold carpet spread in the valley. The two countrymen were delighted. They thanked the good Lama profusely, and offered him a few copper coins as a token of gratitude and reverence. "All is well," said Yongden as we went away. "I have prevented them from drinking and they have served us." He put the coins into the hand of a blind beggar, and thus someone else rejoiced also. In spite of the splendor of the Potala, the present Dalai Lama does not seem to find much charm in it. He goes there only occasionally, at the time of certain festivals. His habitual residence, Norbu Ling, is situated outside of the town in a large park which, owing to the lack of capable gardeners, is not much more than a wooded tract of land cut by a few avenues and paths. A miniature zoo is one of the attractions of the place. This includes a strange poultry yard where only cocks are admitted. The celibate birds number at least 300, and the absence of any ladies of their species appears to have softened their combative instincts. They peck their grain peacefully side by side, and battles are rare. The animals live near one of the gates opening on the high road and even wander on the road in the hope of being fed by people as they pass. Pilgrims, and even inhabitants of Lhasa, go on purpose to throw grain to them, for they belong to the Dalai Lama, and such offering is considered to be meritorious. Several houses reserved for the use of the Tibetan Lama King are scattered in the grounds of the Norbu Ling. The rooms of one of them are furnished in different styles, or at least what Tibetans believe to be different styles. One room they call the English room, another the Indian, another, again, the Chinese room, and, as on the flat roof of the building stand the gilded ornaments called Jiaotsun, emblem of power and victory, the courtiers of the Dalai Lama repeat to satiety before him. All these various rooms, English, Chinese, Indian, and so on, are under the Tibetan roof whereon stand the Tibetan Jiaotsuyin. So Tibet is above all nations, and you are the highest among all rulers. I have been told that this clerical king of Tibet smiles and takes pleasure in these flatteries. One may well doubt his taking them seriously. He has been twice in exile, first in China and then in India, and hence must have learned many things about the world outside Tibet. But if the ruler is perhaps aware of his true situation, it is not the same with the common folk, to whom most extraordinary stories are told about the greatness of the Dalai Lama and the position in which he stands before Great Britain. Very likely the court of Lhasa spreads these absurdities in order to increase the prestige of the Dalai Lama, with which its own is bound up. I will venture to relate one of these stories, as it is rather amusing. At the time when the Dalai Lama was in India, he happened to be the guest of the Viceroy. Once, being seated with the latter and many distinguished guests in a large drawing room, he stretched out his two arms. And behold! On each of his upturned palms appeared one of the hills of Lhasa. On one hand one could see the Potala, on the other the great medical college of Chogburi. At the sight of this marvel the Englishmen were all awestruck. With the Viceroy at their head, they all fell on their knees and bowed down at the feet of the Tibetan pontiff, begging his protection. The King of England was immediately informed of the miracle. He, of course, shared the feelings of his eminent subjects and entreated the Dalai Lama to become the patron of his kingdom, and to grant him his help if he were ever attacked by enemies. The compassionate Lama promised graciously to send him his army should the security of England become endangered. Relying on stories of this kind and misunderstanding some facts the details of which are beyond my present subject, most Tibetans are convinced that they have in some way become suzerains of Great Britain. Thus are explained to them the temporary stays at Lhasa of a British political agent. He comes, they think, to ask respectfully the orders of the Dalai Lama, and to convey them to his British Majesty. This is, of course, funny, but there is to fun of this kind a side fraught with danger for white residents all over Asia, which only those who have lived long in out-of-way regions of the East are able to detect clearly. In Lhasa, one does not see the quaint shops and bazaars that offer such an exciting hunting ground to the collector in China. Nowadays, the most conspicuous articles in the Lhasa market are aluminium wares. For the rest, the display is exclusively composed of inferior goods exported from India, England, Japan, or a few other European countries. I have never seen elsewhere uglier cotton cloth, more hideous crockery than that which one finds on the stalls of the Lhasa merchants. The trade with China, formerly very prosperous, has been so greatly hindered in favor of the goods imported from India that it hardly exists any longer. The importation of tea and manufactured silks still continues, but efforts are being made to drive Chinese products entirely out of the Tibetan market. Coming from China, where silver was plentiful, both in coins and in bullion, a surprise awaited me at Lhasa. There is no more silver in central Tibet. The national money, the tranka, a small thin coin of very low standard, quantities of which were circulating when I was at Shilgats, has nearly disappeared, and the few which remain can only be had at a premium. As for the silver shoes of 50 taels, the tamagma, as the people of Lhasa call them, which were current money when the Chinese occupied the Tibetan capital, they have completely disappeared. The Lhasa government has cast an ugly copper coinage. Potluit is no longer accepted, since it cannot be taken at its face value in any transaction with people who have no business at Lhasa. The Lhasa government has also issued some notes, but they remain an object of curiosity and the traders refuse them. There exists a place near Norbuling where golden coins are stamped, but they do not circulate. I have inquired of many people concerning the cause of this strange disappearance of the silver from central Tibet, seeing that it continues to be plentiful in Chinese Tibet. The answers I have gathered differ according to the social condition and the special turn of mind of those to whom I put the question. Some only smiled when asked where the silver had gone. Others declared, "The government hoards it." But a number of more outspoken fellows told me brutally, "Our government gives it to the filing masters of India, Englishmen, to pay for the old guns, no longer good for their own soldiers, which they sell us. We can fight badly armed Chinese with them, but they would be of no use against two army. The same idea was several times expressed before me in a more original and superstitious way. Before being dispatched to Lhasa, said some Tibetans, the guns sold to their country were deprived of the power of harming the white foreigners or their servants by the magic practice of the filing priests. In the part of Kham conquered by the Lhasa troops, when the country people lament about the considerable rise of the taxes, the Lhasa appointed officials answer that their most kind protector, the Dalai Lama, is not responsible for these hardships, but that the filings tell him to collect money. Why he obeys them, what he receives in exchange for his silver, and many other things, are not of course explained to the simple-minded ones whose brains are not those of a logician. They only remember and bear in mind that these hated wide-eyed foreigners are the cause of their ruin. A very famous festival takes place each year at Lhasa on the evening of the full moon of the first month. Light wooden structures of a large size are entirely covered with ornaments and images of gods, men, and animals, all made of butter and dyed in different colors. These frail frameworks are called tormas. About 100 of them are erected along the park or, that is to say, the streets that form the middle circle of religious circumambulation around the Jokhang, and in front of each one, a large number of butter lamps burn on a small altar. That nocturnal feast is meant to entertain the gods, just as are certain concerts on the roofs of the temples. The Butter Tormas festival at Lhasa is famous all over Tibet, and even in Mongolia and China. It is no doubt truly glorious, yet, I think the feast is much more beautiful in its sumptuous surrounding at the Great Kumbum Lamasery, where I have seen it several times during the years I lived in that monastery. However, I very much enjoy that part of the New Year merrymaking at Lhasa. As soon as darkness had come and the lamps were lighted, Yongdan and I went to the parkour. A dense crowd was there, waiting for the Dalai Lama, who was to go round to inspect the tormas. I had more than once seen big Tibetan gatherings, but I had gone through them with servants and other attendants who made a way for me. This was my first experience of being part of the crowd myself. Groups of sturdy giants, cowmen clad in sheepskin, holding on to one another, ran for joy in the deepest of the throng. Their big fists belabored the ribs of those whom bad luck had placed in their way. Policemen, armed with long sticks and whips, growing more and more excited as the time of the Dalai Lama's coming approached, used their weapons indiscriminately against anybody. In the midst of this tumult, trying our best to guard ourselves against hustling and BBWS, we spent some lively moments. At last the arrival of the Lama King was announced. Then more policemen appeared, followed by soldiers. The knocking, beating, boxing increased. Some ruffians screamed, others laughed. Finally there remained along the walls of the houses that confronted the tormas only a few rows of people, more tightly pressed against one another than tin sardines. I was amongst them. From time to time a man seated at a ground floor window, whose view I was blocking, gave me a strong push in the back, but it was of no use whatever. Even had I wished it, I could not have moved a single step. Finally he understood this, or my insensibility disarmed him. Anyway, he ceased from using unnecessary violence. The whole Lhasa garrison was under arms. Infantry and cavalry marched past the dazzling butter edifices, lighted up by thousands of lamps. In a sedan chair covered with yellow brocade, the Dalai Lama passed in his turn, attended by the commander-in-chief of the Tibetan army and other high officials. Soldiers marched in the rear. The band struck up an English musical tune. Crackers were fired and meager Bengal lights colored the procession red and green for a few minutes. That was all. And the Lamaist ruler had gone. I for a long time after the regal cortege had passed, private processions followed, people of rank surrounded by attendants holding Chinese lanterns, high ecclesiastics with clerical followers, the representatives of the Nepal Maharaja, and many others, clergy, nobility, wealthy traders, and their womenfolk all dressed in their best, laughing, all more or less drunk and happy. Their gaiety was contagious. Yongdan and I went with the crowd, running, jostling, and pushing like everybody else, enjoying as youngsters might have done the fun of being there in Lhasa, feasting the new year with the Tibetans. When at last the time came to go back to our hovel, we noticed on our way that the streets which ought to have been well lighted by the full moon were growing darker and darker. What did it mean? We are teetotalers, and could not have the same reason as most citizens on that night, for clouded vision. We reached a square, and noticed a black shadow in a corner of the moo. It was the beginning of an eclipse, and soon we heard a noise of drums made by the good people to frighten away the dragon which was trying to swallow the nocturnal luminary. The eclipse was total. I observed it during the night, and it was the most interesting one that I had ever witnessed. This is still better than the curtain of sand before the Potala, on the day of our arrival, said Yongdan, jocularly. Now your gods are screening the moon so that we shall not be seen too distinctly. I think you had better ask them to stop their kind protection of our incognito. They might put out the sun. Whatever may have been the protection with which I was favored, the day came when the safety of my disguise was again endangered and I had to defend myself in my own way. I was wandering in the market when a policeman stopped and gazed at me intently. Why? Perhaps he only wondered from what part of Tibet I might hail, but it was better to be prepared for the worst. A new battle was to be fought, and I began it, my heart beating rather quickly, but brave as usual. I chose, amongst the things for sale, an aluminium saucepan, and began to bargain for it with that ridiculous obstinacy shown by the people of the half-willed tribes of the borderland. I offered an absurd price and talked nonsense in a loud voice, hardly stopping to breathe. People around the booths began to laugh and exchange jokes about me. The cowmen and women of the northern solitudes are a habitual subject of mockery for the more civilized people of Lhasa. Ah! Said the merchant, laughing, and yet irritated by my continuous waddle, you are a true Dokpa, there can w no doubt of that. And all present ridiculed the stupid woman who knew nothing beside her cattle and the grass of the desert. The policeman passed on, amused like everybody else. I bought the saucepan, and, as I feared being followed, I compelled myself to loiter about the market, playing a comedy of admiration and stupidity before the ugliest and cheapest goods. Then my good luck caused me to fall in with a group of true Dokpas. I began to talk with them in their own dialect. I had lived in their country some years ago. I spoke of places and men known to them, and they were convinced that I was born in a neighboring tribe. I have no doubt that, with the quickness of imagination that is peculiar to them, they would, next day, have sworn in all sincerity that they had known me for a long time. A second incident happened a few days later. A kind of special constable tried to extort money from me, but I managed the affair cleverly enough to give him nothing without disclosing my identity. Still another policeman hit me with his truncheon because I had trespassed in a place where quality only were admitted, and truly I had to make a great effort to prevent myself from giving a gratuity to that man, so delighted was I with the fun. What a wonderful incognito is mine! I confided to Yongdan. Now I am even beaten in the street. And after that I felt completely secure. Lhasa is divided into several quarters, Yuthog, Lebu, Ramush, Lhasa Hol, Simaling, Tenyaling, Sekoling, Banajong, Parka, Norbu Linga. The city boasts of a bridge and an obelisk. The bridge is of Chinese shape, painted red and roofed with green tiles. Its name, Turquoise Roofed Bridge, is derived from a noble Tibetan family whose dwelling is in the vicinity. An ancestor of that family having received from the Chinese emperor the distinction of the turquoise knob. The obelisk is much shorter than that which one sees in the Place de la Concorde at Paris. Yet, even though it has no hieroglyphics, it makes quite a respectable appearance. In front of it, on the highway, at the foot of the Potala, a tablet bearing Chinese and Tibetan writing is sheltered by a small building. That highway, humble as may be its appearance, is one of the great arteries of the world. Starting from India, it crosses Central Asia, enters Mongolia, and ends in Siberia, a long trek which cuts through high ranges of mountains, but does not offer great difficulties to a good horseman. During the winter, when the temperature allows one to carry provisions of ice for drinking purposes, travelers can follow the road nearly in a straight line across a waterless region. In the summer, they follow the devious route, passing to the east of the Blue Lake, the Kokonor of which I have already spoken. One day, perhaps not far distant, Transasiatic Expresses will carry their parties of tourists, seated in comfortable sleeping and salon cars. But then the charm of the journey will be greatly diminished. As for me, I am glad to have traveled from Ceylon to Mongolia before this happens. The capital of Tibet is a town full of animation, inhabited by jolly people whose greatest pleasure is to loiter and chat out of doors. Although the population is far from being considerable, the streets are crowded from sunrise to sunset, but it is not deemed prudent to go out after dusk. The citizens say that the establishment of a national police and army have much increased the insecurity, for the official protectors of the public safety often turn robbers when darkness has come. With the exception of a small part of the town, the streets of Lhasa are large, with broad squares at their points of intersection, and relatively clean. Unfortunately, there is no sanitary accommodation in many houses, some empty plots of ground being reserved for this purpose in different quarters of the town. Several important monasteries are situated in Lhasa itself, amongst them the two famous colleges where Tantrism, magic, ritual and occult sciences are taught. The three great lamaseries whose fame attracts thousands of pilgrims and where young lamas come to study from even the farthest regions of Mongolia and Manchuria, are not in Lhasa, but in its vicinity. Sera, already mentioned, stands about 4 miles behind the Potala, Dipung is about 6 miles away, on the road to India, and Golden is hidden in a circle of mountains 20 miles distant. These three, even if they are the largest dot and the most powers, full, being state lamaseries, are not the only ones which Tibetans hold in high esteem. Amongst others, one can name Tashilampo, the monastery of the Pendjin Rinpoche. It is located at Shigatse, in the Tsang province, and is considered to be the highest seat of learning in all Tibet. Several days' march from it stands the old historical monastery of Sakya, where lives the head of an important Red Cap sect. It contains an unique library of old Sanskrit and Tibetan manuscripts. Besides these, there exist many others, such as Labrang Tashikiil in Amdo, Kambum in the same province, Dzogchen in the solitudes of northeastern Tibet, and countless others. Tibet is essentially a monastic country. While in the west our important buildings are generally schools, hospitals, factories and other products of worldly activities, in Tibet the Gompazo are the only edifices offered to the attention of the traveler. Standing on the summits, silhouetted against the azure sky, or else concealed in the recesses of the mountains, all over the country, they symbolize a lofty ideal but one little understood nowadays even by their inmates. The religious communities of Tibet form little states within the state, of which they are almost entirely independent. All are possessed of lands and cattle. As a rule, they carry on commerce of some kind. The larger Gompas rule over a considerable territory peopled by tenants whose condition resembles that of the serfs of Europe in the Middle Ages. They cultivate, for their own profit, the land belonging to the monasteries and in return they pay each year a definite quantity of cereals, forage, and so forth. The families who devote themselves to rearing cattle pay their debt in butter, cheese, wool, and dried cow dung for fuel, and the surplus produce of the docks also goes to them. All these serfs are obliged to undertake certain statute labors, such as the transport of the baggage of the Khmers when they travel, and of the goods sent for sale to other regions by the managers of the monastery's temporal affairs, also the repair of the monastic buildings and various other menial offices. They are also forbidden to leave the country without obtaining permission, but this is rarely refused to anyone who wishes to absent himself for the purpose of trading, studying, making a pilgrimage, or any other good reason. However restricted the liberty of these tenants may be, their situarian is infinitely preferable to that of their compatriots established upon the domain of some great lay lord, and especially of those who are direly dependent upon the central government. It is rare for the heads of the monasteries to be hard upon their subjects, and, in return for the tax they pay, the peasants are really and effectively protected by the high religious dignitaries upon whom they depend. They also escape official civil jurisdiction. The misdemeanors and even crimes they may commit are judged by dignitaries of the gompa to which they belong. Latterly, the Lhasa government, although ecclesiastical in character, is seeking to encroach upon the privileges of the monasteries, and especially to reduce their rights of jurisdiction, a fact which arouses vehement protestations, not only from the Lamas, but from those under their rule. The inhabitants of the Gompas do not live in communities, although a kind of community of wealth exists among them by virtue of the fact that each receives a share of the income of the monastery. Part of these shares are delivered in kind corn, butter, tea, etc. They differ considerably in importance, first of all, according to the wealth of the monasteries, and then according to the hierarchical standing of each monk. The monks have yet other sources of revenue, a portion of the gifts given to their gompa, the performance of religious ceremonies, the presents offered by the relatives of the young men they instruct, etc. Lack of space makes it impossible for me to mention all of them in detail. In spite of all the criticism that may justly be directed against the gompas, they afford an excellent retreat for the student, the thinker, and anyone else who desires an intellectual or spiritual life. Almost entirely free from material cares, the humblest lama may give himself up to a leisurely study of the religious and philosophical literature of his country, and if he succeeds in learning Chinese or Sanskrit and thus extending the field of his researches, he is greatly admired by his colleagues. It is very true that many lamas do not seem to possess any of the qualities which a religious vocation demands, but the way in which they have been brought into the monasteries often affords sufficient excuse. Every Tibetan family esteems it an honor for one or more of its sons to adopt the religious habit, and, to this end, the boys destined to the priestly state are taken to the gompa at the age of 8 or 9, and handed over to a master charged with their education. Life vows do not exist among the Buddhists, who believe in the fundamental impermanence of all things, and these children may, therefore, return later on to the world and live as laymen without incurring the disesteem of their compatriots. Some of them do so, but many, not feeling sufficiently courageous to apprentice themselves to any other career, maintain the habit of the order without respecting it as they should. As a rule, these drones of lamaism, somewhat lazy and gossiping, a trifle too gluttonous and especially too greedy of gain, are charitable and hospitable folks in spite of their faults. We may add to their credit, moreover, that however feeble their morals or limited their intelligence, they do maintain a reverence for learning and saintliness, being always ready to venerate those of their companions who rise above them by virtue of erudition or loftiness of character. A large monastery in Tibet is a veritable town, the population of which sometimes amounts to as many as 10,000 persons. It is composed of a network of streets and alleys, squares and gardens. Temples in larger or smaller numbers, the assembly halls of the different colleges, and the palaces of the dignitaries rise above the common dwellings, their gilded roofs and terraces surmounted by banners and divers ornaments. In the gompa every lama lives by himself in a house of which he is sole proprietor, whether he has had it built at his own cost or bought or inherited it. This dwelling may be bequeathed by the lama to one of his pupils or to a relative, but the legatee must himself belong to the religious order. No layman is allowed to possess a house in a monastery. Certain high monastic palaces are veritable museums, full of artistic treasures. In them have been accumulated gifts received by a long line of grand lamas, or precious things acquired by themselves, over a period of several centuries. Enamel, lacquer, rare porcelain, marvelous embroideries, and the paintings of Chinese or Tibetan artists are to be seen there. To find such manors isolated in the midst of the vast steppes, or hidden in immense virgin forests, seems like a fairy tale. But is not everything a fairy tale in this extraordinary country, even to the name it gives itself, that of Kangyul, the land of snows? I have had the privilege, unique in these days, of living in several monasteries. After what I have said of them, and of their separate houses, one can understand how it was possible for a woman to live there,